Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 08-5159, Baptist Memorial Hospital, Golden Triangle et al. Appellant versus Charles E. Johnson in his official capacity as Acting Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services. Mr. Alderman for the appellants, Ms. Kaiser for the appellee.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'm Les Alderman, and I represent the appellants in this case. The big question for the court today is whether the initial dismissals of these two group appeals was with prejudice to the hospital's rights to pursue those dismissed issues in their then existing individual appeals that were then before the board. The analysis that we go on is the Chevron analysis. So Chevron 1, Chevron 2, we start with Chevron 1 and determine if the plain meaning of the board's instructions mandates a particular ruling. And in this case, it does. The plain meaning of the board's instructions is that a provider may be dismissed, but not with prejudice.
Well, what's the purpose of the reinstatement provision then? It would seem to me that the combination of the dismissal provision plus the reinstatement provision suggests that if you don't do the follow the reinstatement provision, that's it.
The reinstatement provision is there because a dismissal, even without prejudice, can be tantamount to dismissal with prejudice if that dismissal comes beyond the 180-day deadline for the hospital to file its individual appeal or group appeal if the case is being initiated by way of group appeal. So, for example, a hospital files its individual appeal. It does so on the 100th day on the 180-day deadline. It then gets dismissed for failing to file a position paper. Position papers normally are due months after the appeal is initially filed. Therefore, even a dismissal without prejudice is going to render that hospital too late to initiate a new individual appeal. It's just like in litigation before the federal courts. Dismissal is without prejudice in most cases. And in many instances, the litigants have time under their statute of limitations to simply refile their complaint. So in this case, the reinstatement is similar to a motion under Rule 6B1B for extension of time after the deadline, or Rule 59, motion for reconsideration. It still has effect with the appellant's interpretation of the instructions. So getting back to the plain language of the instructions.
Could you explain what the timing rules are on exercising the reinstatement right?
Well, under the reinstatement provision itself, I'm not sure what the deadline for seeking reinstatement is. If you're asking what the deadline for a hospital
is. What you're saying then is that if all these dismissals are treated as without prejudice, You're saying that the reinstatement provision is sort of a backstop for hospitals that get trapped by this timing issue.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. The reinstatement provision applies when the hospital doesn't have time to refile the appeal in the first place because the 180-day provision deadline has already passed. We also know from the plain meaning of the instructions that dismissal for failing to meet a deadline is without prejudice, because when the board intended a dismissal to be with prejudice, it said specifically that.
Well, that's a very standard argument, but not always a winner.
But in this case, Your Honor, not only do they use the right language, do they use both terms, they use them under different factual contexts. So, and they use it appropriately, which is even more important. So here the board punishes the more egregious conduct of failing to show up at a scheduled hearing with dismissal with prejudice.
Do you have any practiced evidence to support your interpretation? Because it's certainly not plain meaning in that, in the sense in which you're trying to. Well, any practice?
Your Honor,
any cases in which the board has interpreted its rules? We do give deference to their interpretation of their own rules. It's not Chevron 1. This is a regulation you're talking about.
Your Honor, I guess that raises three points. One, unfortunately, we did not have access to discovery in this case, so we weren't able to find out what the board does in these cases. And these decisions are not regularly published by the board. So there's no way to know, except for by anecdotal and experience, what the board does in these circumstances. We were denied discovery. We think we found some cases where the board has done different things. The Rhode Island Hospital case is one example where the secretary said that under identically factual circumstances, the board did the exact opposite thing. But also, Your Honor, with respect to the deference question, even under interpretation of regulations and interpretive guidances like we have today, this court's precedent and the Supreme Court precedent is that you do a Chevron analysis. You first look to the plain meaning of any language that you're trying to interpret. And we've got cases on that point in both the appellate brief and the reply brief. So the Chevron 1 analysis is there. You don't get into deference or the agency's interpretation unless you have to, unless the plain meaning doesn't mandate a particular result.
You're trying to argue that the plain meaning is that it means that dismissal means dismissal without prejudice?
That's right. And the reason is when they intend to use dismissal with prejudice, they say it. Also, they've now changed the regulations. So now, after notice and comment rulemaking on the part of the secretary, the board has now implemented regulations that permit dismissal with prejudice. But it only happened after that notice and comment rulemaking. Additionally, the secretary has yet to explain why it uses dismissal and dismissal with prejudice to apparently mean the same thing. The secretary has yet to come up with an explanation for why it used two different terms to mean the same thing. So in our view, they've conceded the point on the plain meaning argument.
Do we have any evidence about how frequently this timing issue that you raise turns up, is a problem?
Well, what I can tell you, Judge Williams, is that it's not a problem anymore. And that's because the board has changed its instructions entirely. The factual scenario that we present to you today cannot happen again. And that's because of several changes to the instructions. First, the board has now imposed a 60-day deadline to raise new issues that a provider wants to address in an appeal. So if that 60-day deadline has passed once the appeal is filed, then the provider may no longer raise issues in that individual appeal.
Go ahead.
Yes,
go on.
Secondly, the board has the authority to dismiss with prejudice for failing to meet deadlines. So the board, if it wants to, now can clearly do so.
The problem you raised in your brief was that, at least as I understood it, that treating this sort of dismissal as being with prejudice, well, I'm sorry, even treating it as not with prejudice, a theoretical right to refile was largely theoretical, because frequently the time would have run by the time you learned of the dismissal, making it too late to meet the deadline.
That's right.
And I guess the force of that depends partly on what rules there are, whether there's any, whether the board ever allows slack in light of, for the refiling, in light of this bind that you identify.
Again, we don't know because we didn't have access to discovery. Right. But what I can tell you is that there are three ways, at least under the old instructions, there were three ways that a provider can raise an appeal. in two of those ways, the timing issue is a major problem. If the hospital has an individual appeal and the individual appeal gets dismissed beyond the 180-day deadline, that case is gone. If the hospital initiates its appeal as a group appeal and the 180-day deadline goes, that case is gone. So the limited circumstance in which our interpretation, our argument applies, is when the hospital raises the issue as an individual appeal and then transfers issues, but not all of the issues, to a group appeal. So it really happens in a limited set of circumstances. I see that I'm into my rebuttal time, but what I'd like to present to the court beforehand is the due process argument. There's plenty of cases from this circuit and the Supreme Court that mandate that an agency has to let the people who are litigating before it know of the penalties for their actions. In this case, what you've got is notice that an appeal may be dismissed, but not dismissed with prejudice. So there are real due process concerns.
It was dismissed for failure to comply with the procedures, correct?
That's correct.
And then
failure to file.
Right. And the reinstatement provision says if you're requesting reinstatement because the board dismissed your appeal for failure to comply with its procedures, you must explain in detail the reasons why you failed to comply.
Right. If you're seeking reinstatement.
That was not done here, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
What did you just say?
Well, if you're seeking reinstatement because you've been dismissed for failing to file a deadline, failing to meet a deadline, then you have to explain why you failed to meet the deadline. But take it back to the analogy of litigation in the federal courts. If your case is dismissed without prejudice, the smart thing to do for a litigant is to refile the complaint to get it in on time, not to seek reconsideration.
Why have deadlines or procedures at all?
The deadlines.
If your interpretation is correct.
These deadlines.
Why follow them?
These deadlines matter. One, missing a deadline puts your case in jeopardy. You could be out of time to refile your appeal. Second, if you are out of time, then the reinstatement provision kicks in, but there's no guarantee that you're going to have your case reinstated. So these deadlines are important and crucial, and the hospitals, at least under the old instructions, put their case at jeopardy.
You're trying to make this a case comparable to a situation where your client voluntarily withdrew and refiled within the proper time.
Well, we don't say that our...
This is not adverse to your position.
It would not be adverse.
This is not a gotcha question.
No, I understand.
you're trying to make it analogous to a situation where, for whatever reason, your client voluntarily withdraws and then refiles within proper time.
That would be the analogy that I think is more on point is a case that gets dismissed without prejudice within time to refile.
That's the question here. So I'm trying to think what your one that would not be controversial. I don't think the government objects or would oppose this. That is a situation where you voluntarily withdraw and then refile for whatever reason.
For whatever reason.
And then refile within time. If you're saying I can do that, why not here?
You can do that, and the Secretary's regulations permit you to do that. Also, one more point, Your Honor, on the deference issue, because I think it's an important point, and this is one of those tough deference areas. The instructions are interpretive guidelines interpreting regulations, the Secretary's regulations, that apply to the procedure before the board. So the Secretary has regulations in the CFR. That's 42 CFR,
yeah,
405, 1835.
Those regulations are the authorization of the instructions.
Well,
so the procedural rules, the regulations say there will be procedural rules in the instructions. So you have reason to know to go look at the instructions.
Yes, Your Honor. But the point is, the instructions interpret the regulations. Those regulations also talk about.
The instructions simply promulgate regulations pursuant to the authorization coming from the Secretary.
It's still a third level.
It doesn't matter. It's promulgated pursuant to regulations adopted by the secretary. There's no doubt that there was the authority to promulgate instructions. Your fight is over what do the instructions mean.
Yes, Your Honor. And then the question is deference. What deference is owed? So you've got interpretive guidelines that in and of themselves may not be entitled to deference.
Why?
Because they're not promulgated by notice and comment rulemaking.
Procedural rules?
These procedural rules.
Have to be notice and comment rulemaking?
If they change substantive legal rights. And permitting dismissal with prejudice, permitting a dismissal with res judicata effect.
Did you play that out in your brief, that line of cases?
We discussed the need for notice and comment rulemaking when it changes substantive rights. The point is, this gets into the regulatory muck that this court addressed in paralyzed veterans. The board's instructions, which are themselves an interpretation of the regulations, this is an interpretation of the interpretation.
The regulations weren't changed here.
My point, Your Honor.
The question really is whether or not you can draw meaning from the instruction in the way that the government has done it.
And we think that you can't because of the plan.
I mean, it's self-serving to say they changed it. What you're saying is they can't get that meaning out of it.
They can't.
You're saying if they want it, you're starting from your assumption, the winning assumption. And if they go otherwise, you're saying that's a change which requires notice and comment rulemaking.
Well, no, this point is on deference, is on the interpretation. My only point is that the board is interpreting in a litigation position what is in itself an interpretive guideline. So this gets into an agency can't just pass or promulgate muck and then be free to give it any meaning it desires, and that's paralyzed veterans. It's also Justice Thomas's dissent in Thomas Jefferson. Thank you very much.
Good morning, and may it please the court, Bridget Kaiser for the appellee. As has been mentioned, the board is entitled to deference in interpreting its instructions. The board doesn't.
I noticed that you never responded to the hospital's argument that in another provision of the instructions, it does explicitly say with prejudice, and they make a standard argument based on that difference in language.
Right.
Now you have an opportunity to respond to that.
And I would like to respond to that. The board, it's true that the board's decisions never addressed the meaning of its instructions regarding dismissals, but that is because the providers here never made this argument to them. The providers...
I'm talking about your brief here.
Right. The board...
The brief before us never recognized that other provision of the instructions. At least
right.
You don't cite it.
That's correct. That was because the board never had the opportunity to express, has not given any explanation of this
No, but you
difference.
Had an opportunity
yes.
in the litigation, right? Well, anyway, so now what is your explanation, your reconciliation of the use of with prejudice in one place and not in another, but both with the same meaning?
I don't know why they didn't use the phrase with prejudice as to... dismissals for failure to follow its rules, but we believe that the instructions are, that its interpretation of those instructions is reasonable, putting together the repeated warnings for the consequences of failure to meet deadlines will be dismissal, and the provision of a reinstatement provision.
Begs the question, what kind of dismissal?
That's right. The instructions are silent as to what kind of dismissal, but the board is entitled to deference in interpreting.
Yeah, but you have to give, in the regulatory context, you have to give parties reasonable notice of what it is you mean to do if there are adverse effects that will follow. And why would anyone assume that a dismissal is with prejudice if you're still within the time period to file again and meet the deadlines for filing?
Well, there's
that's not intuitive. Why would I assume that?
Well, there's
I can volunteer. Let me just finish. I didn't mean to interrupt you. Let me finish my thought. Because I can withdraw on my own motion and file again within time limits. That's what we normally assume, unless someone says to the contrary. So how did they get notice that this could happen?
Well, first I would say the instructions also have procedures for withdrawing your appeal if that's what you wish to do, which they didn't do here.
That leaves the analogy still as powerful as it was when Judge Edwards laid it out.
There's nothing in the instructions to suggest that the reinstatement provision applies only to one class of providers and not to another. It doesn't say anything about if your claim is otherwise untimely, you need to seek reinstatement.
Yeah, but I don't see that helps you much, because your big argument for giving the strong reading to dismiss in this context was that otherwise it renders the reinstatement provision just useless. But they argue, with some justice, it seems, that there is a wide range of cases where, in fact, the reinstatement provision would be critical. So that seems to at least strongly weaken the force of your argument.
Well, it may, on their reading, still have some effect as to some providers, but it wouldn't.
Clearly.
But it wouldn't.
It's not a nullity. I mean, that's the thing that's coming across loud and clear now, which I can't say I completely understood before, but it's something you have to give an answer to. The reinstatement provision is not nullified with their interpretation. So now my concern, quite frankly, is why would I have reason to understand that the instruction is with prejudice with respect to something that I can refile on within your deadlines?
Even if it's,
yeah, you normally assume you can withdraw, remove yourself, and refile within time limits, and that's okay unless someone says, no, you can't.
Well, I think that analogy with this, what can happen in district court only goes so far with the board. The board has, when they file these appeals with the board, it's not like just filing a complaint. They can. Every appeal could have scores of issues. Group appeals could have scores of providers in them. It's very disruptive to have people not meet their providers not meet their deadlines. On their reading of this interpretation, the board would end up penalized, because then a group appeal, when it if they failed to meet their deadlines, if they could then only pursue their issues in individual appeals, now the board has to hear those issues in all the different individual appeals and loses the benefit of group appeals. There's no reason to think that the board would want to have the system set up that way.
They don't have to go to the group appeal in the first place.
No, they don't.
Right. So I mean, I'm not getting it. What do you mean the board loses the advantage? The board is not guaranteed that advantage. It depends upon what the party decides to do.
No, what I mean to suggest is the board has no reason to deprive itself of that option by permitting providers only those class of providers who still have individual pending appeals, and only them, to do what the providers did here, which is to assume that the reinstatement procedure was optional as to them. They made an at best they have identified an ambiguity in the instructions and interpreted it favorably to themselves.
And you interpret it favorably to
yourself,
you.
Right.
And I think the board is entitled to in deference in interpreting its instructions.
Well, but not, you're
not
entitled
unlimited.
To deference, but there has to be some reason, there has to be something that convinces us that the other side has no, or would have reason to understand that this was a viable possibility. It can't be merely because, look, the agency said it, so we win. There has to be something that undergirds it. What's reasonable about the interpretation other than you said it?
In each case, and I'd like to go back to the requests that actually led to the decisions that they have challenged here, because these were not the issues that were before the board. They simply refiled. The board said you had the opportunity to pursue your appeal, and you didn't follow our deadlines. You are dismissed.
on the group.
As to the 2004 group appeals. When they sought reconsideration, what they said was, we raised new issues in these group appeals, something they've since abandoned. They never claimed that they misunderstood or weren't on notice as to this the meaning of being dismissed. And I think this undercuts their argument that they weren't aware that this was the board's interpretation. In fact, as to one of these requests, the July 18th, 2006 request of St. Joseph, they didn't make any explanation at all. They simply tried to add the issue in without mentioning or disclosing that it had already been the subject of two previous dismissals, leaving it to the board and the fiscal intermediary to realize that they'd seen this case twice before. So I don't think that they weren't on notice of the board's interpretation. And they've never, the board makes clear, I think, in its instructions that it wants the chance to consider why people miss their deadlines.
What about the situation where you're going from group to individual, group back to individual, which was at least one of the petitioners here, right?
Right, that was the one where they didn't explain what they were. That was the July 18th, 2006 one. They simply tried to St. Joseph tried to transfer these issues from appeals from which they'd already been dismissed without disclosing that they'd been dismissed twice on this issue for that fiscal year. In fact, St. Joseph is the only one of these three providers who's tried to add these issues directly into its individual appeal.
The burden to the board, I mean, since they can do anything, let's say before they trouble the board with a filing, they can organize their claims however they like up to the 180-day limit, right?
Right.
So try to communicate to me how the board is adversely affected by the interpretation they propose here, except, and I don't suggest it's trivial, except in that the board will have wasted some time looking at a file and dismissing a case for failure to meet a deadline.
Right.
That's it.
Yes, they create a whole new case number.
A whole new case number doesn't sound terribly burdensome.
You were just warming up, right?
But when issues like this happen, then there was a whole jurisdictional dispute with a fiscal intermediary whether these were the same issues or whether they weren't. And much briefing was spent on whether these were or weren't the same issues. Because they didn't meet their deadline and didn't file the position paper, it was impossible to know what the issues were that were raised in the group appeals. The board has thousands of cases before it. It may seem like a small matter when one provider transfers one issue to a group and back, but repeated over thousands of times, when the providers don't keep track of their appeals and don't disclose all the relevant facts and their findings, it inconveniences and wastes the time of the fiscal intermediaries and the board, which was part of the reasons that the secretary mentioned in the preamble to the new regulations that they were trying to help the board deal with some of these providers transferring issues back and forth all the time.
For purposes of the notice, the reinstatement provision is key, correct?
I'm sorry.
For purposes of the notice question that we're discussing, the reinstatement provision is key to your argument, correct? In other words, you're saying that the reinstatement provision gives you notice that there is a way, if you're dismissed, to get the case reinstated.
I think it's key. It's one of two key things. The other key is they repeatedly warn, you will be dismissed, you will be dismissed. I think that the tone of the warnings, the repeated warnings, show that they mean for that to have some consequence. But yes, I do think that they were.
And even if that's not enough, the reinstatement shows you, well, if you are dismissed, here's the procedure to get it back.
And they expect you to explain why you missed the relevant deadline, and to permit them in their own discretion to determine whether you had good cause to meet the deadline, which the providers here have never done to this day, explained why they missed the deadline. Actually, unless you have other questions on the other issues in the briefs, I don't have anything further to say.
Thank you. 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Kind of shotgun approach to some issues that I think were raised. First, and this can't be understated, Chevron 1 first, plain meaning first. We don't get into agency interpretation until we figure out if the plain meaning mandates a particular result. That's In Re Sealed Case, that's Gardebring, both of those cases cited in the appellant's brief. In their brief, the Secretary's only argument against our plain meaning argument is that
if we conclude that the plain meaning doesn't entail dismissal, meaning dismissal without prejudice, do you lose?
No, we don't lose. We don't lose.
Why not?
Because even if we get into the interpretation, the Secretary's interpretation is unreasonable. It violates due process. It ignores inconsistent terms. It's based on what the Secretary and counsel has just argued was an assumption, an unanalyzed assumption that dismissal meant dismissal with prejudice. It goes against notice and comment rulemaking requirement for changing substantive laws. It goes against.
But I'm sorry, there isn't anything in the underlying regulation that's changed by this interpretation of the instruction, is there?
Well, yes, there is.
If
you look at the statute and the regulations, and then the Supreme Court's case Bethesda, what that says is the board gets jurisdiction over a cost report. Board gets jurisdiction over a cost report, and the hospitals may litigate any issues raised in that cost report. It's absolutely unlimited in the statute and the regulation.
But that's obviously subject to procedural rules, and the board promulgated procedural rules.
It's the weight and clarity of those procedural rules. And if you look at the board's decision in St. Cloud.
Just to go back.
Okay.
There is not a contradiction. Yeah, at least I have not heard a contradiction between the board's interpretation here and any rule.
Your Honor, what we would argue is that if the statute, the regulations, and Supreme Court precedent allows a hospital to raise any issue that's in a cost report, and you have an instruction by the board that limits that right, then it has countermanded. It is contrary.
You think because the statute says you can raise it, there can be no time limits or procedural constraints?
No, Your Honor.
You can raise it anytime you want from now until the end of time?
The time limits are built into the statute.
And there can be no other procedural prescriptions other than what you can find in the statute?
I would disagree with that.
Because no, I'm asking the
question. No, that's not our argument. We think that by notice and comment rulemaking, you can impose those kind of deadlines.
So you're saying, is the heart of your argument that the instructions are a nullity? They can't happen because they were not promulgated by notice and comment rulemaking?
No. The instructions can't be contrary to rights established in the regulations and the statute. And if you go back to the board.
The statute doesn't say anything about dismissal without prejudice.
Right.
What
right?
The statute says is board jurisdiction attaches to cost reports that only final decisions are final decisions and appealable. Here we've got no quorum, no indication that it's a final decision.
I haven't heard a contradiction yet.
Raised. Come on, you're right. It's a shotgun now. That wasn't raised for us. Stay where you were.
what we'd like to finish on, Your Honor, is if you take a look at the if, that the board's interpretation of its own authority, that this is the St. Cloud decision that we sent in as a supplemental authority a couple days ago. What the board says there is, in light of the provider's right to raise issues in their that they were included in the cost report, there has to be some clear limitation, some clear authority to limit that right. And in the St. Cloud case, there was a letter from the board to the hospitals that said, you may raise this one issue in your individual appeal. Go for it. The hospital reinstated the appeal and then raised additional issues. And the board said, in light of the hospital's right to add issues, our notice to them wasn't clear enough to limit the right. Likewise, in these instructions, the notice to the hospitals, the notice that there's some limitation, and certainly a limitation with prejudice, is not clear enough to countermand those rights in the statute and the regulations.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.